I for president.
You like Ike. I like Ike. Everybody likes Ike.
For president. A campaign ad for Dwight Eisenhower. They sure do like Ike, it sounds like, but how does history rate him? And how about the rest of the presidents, from Abe Lincoln to Zachary Taylor? I'm Rob Ferret, filling in for Kathleen Dunn. It's about 7 minutes after 10 here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We will rate the presidents this hour. Who is the best? Who is the worst? Who is underrated and overrated historically? You could share your answer to those questions at 800-642-1234 or talk at WPR.org. But we're going to leave the most recent out of the question and out of your answers. So no Barack Obama, no George W. Bush, just to make things a little more interesting. Bob Mary joins the show. He's the editor of The National Interest, and his new book is Where They Stand, The American Presidents in the Eyes of Voters and Historians. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Glad you could join us. Now, you are a fan of presidents and the presidency, you say in your book. Why are you a fan?
Well, I've always been interested in American politics, and the presidency is at the fulcrum of American politics, which means that it is also at the fulcrum of American history. As a historian, that makes me interested and fixated sometimes on the presidency and on presidents. And I covered the White House when I was a reporter for the Wall Street Journal in Washington, D.C. years ago in the Reagan administration. So I spent a lot of time tracking these guys and trying to figure out what made them tick.
And now, why is it fun for us to rate the presidents?
Well, I suppose it's the same reason that it's fun for us to rate first basemen in the major leagues or great singers of the post-war era. It's a game. And I just took this game and said, I'm going to see if I can't pull that into a discussion of American history, focus on presidents and how they fail and succeed and how we assess their performance, both at the time of their being in office and also in history. So that's how the book came about.
Sure. And now what can we learn from playing the rating game? We'll talk about the history of the rating game a little bit in a minute, but does it benefit us? Does it tell us something?
Well, I think it tells us a lot. It tells us a lot about how presidents fail and succeed, and therefore it tells us how presidents manage to capture the time in which they're leading the nation or trying to lead the nation, and therefore it's telling us what's going on in the country. So I think the presidents represent a very good prism into American history, and I'm hoping that people will see that I succeeded where I sought, which is to bundle up a lot of American history into a discussion of presidents.
Now let's look at how you did it. You used two different ways to rate the presidents. First, you look at the voters themselves. What are you looking at there?
Well, the contemporaneous judgment of the electorate. I thought that the polls of the historians, which was there have been many of them since 1948 when Arthur Schlesinger Sr. of Harvard University began this process of polling historians and academics on the presidents and their performance and rating them or ranking them, as it were. And that was not an inconsiderable body of evidence in terms of how these guys did. But I thought what was missing in that analysis, often, not always, was a sense of the contemporaneous judgment of the electorate. What were the voters thinking? So a two-term president obviously is higher regarded by the voters than a one-term president. A two-term president succeeded by his own party would mean that he had two terms that the electorate generally liked sufficient to keep the incumbent party in power. So that's really kind of like the major index in terms of the voters' judgment.
And then on the other hand, you did also do some looking at what historians said, like a lot of the past polls had done.
Right. I bundled them all up. I mean, there's a fair number of them. I didn't really look at all of them, but I looked at what I thought were the really major ones since 1948 and attempted to, I didn't try to average them or anything like that, but I looked at them individually and then in terms of the progression to determine what history was saying about these guys.
And there's been a worry in the past on the historians' rating side that some ideological bias creeps in. And accusations that, well, of course, historians in academic settings lean more liberal, are going to support more reformist or big government types. How important is it to separate that out or to try to account for that?
Well, that's a very interesting question. And what I found interesting was that, yes, indeed, I think that there are instances, especially when a new president or a new ex-president, a newly retired president is brought into the polls, where you see this bias. And the two most stark examples would be Dwight Eisenhower in the first poll after he left office, which was 1962, also by Arthur Schlesinger Sr., and Ronald Reagan in extensive polling that took place just as he was leaving office in 1989. And what happened, however, in Eisenhower's case, let's take him as a kind of a case study. He was down there really in the also-rans, even below that. He was down there with Chester Arthur, who was a non-entity president, and Andrew Johnson, who lost control of the government that he was supposed to lead. And there was Eisenhower down there, 27 or something like that. And the Republicans of the nation were very upset about this, especially since that was also the first poll in which Truman was rated, and he's up there in the near-great category. So what happened, however, was that in subsequent polls, Eisenhower just did a steady rise until he made it himself into the near-great category, usually ranked very close to Truman. So Eisenhower now is somewhere between 9th and 14th, which I think is probably a pretty reasonable assessment of his 8-year presidency. And Reagan is making the way up. He was ranked very, very low in an extensive poll, which also asked a lot of questions about what was wrong with Reagan, manifested a very stark ideological perspective on the part of a great number of those who were polled. There were 750 or so who were polled in that poll. But he's also making his way up, as I think a perspective of history is sort of taking hold.
That's Bob Mary. He's author of the new book, Where They Stand. He's rating the presidents in the eyes of voters and historians. And you can rate them, too, with your call at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. Apart from the two most recent, for reasons that Bob just kind of explained, we're going to leave out Barack Obama and George W. Bush. Who are the best presidents? Who are the worst? Who do you think, well, even if they're not at the top or bottom of your list, who do you think gets a bad rap? Who's underrated? Who's overrated? 800-642-1234. Rob Ferret filling in this week for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. Now, Bob, I think the thing everybody's waiting for is now is who's at the top of the list in the ways you rated it? Who are the greats?
Well, the greats, what's interesting is that largely the greats on the basis of the historian polls track with the greats on the basis of voter, contemporaneous voter judgment. In other words, most of the greats are two-term presidents succeeded by their own party. So let's just go through them. The presidents that I call leaders of destiny are presidents that meet a three-way test. First, they are consistently in the great or near-great category in the historian polls. Number two, they are two-term presidents succeeded by their own party or partial terms. And number three, my test, which is to be a leader of destiny, not just a great president, but a leader of destiny, you have to have altered, transformed the American political landscape and set the country upon a new course. And that's, number one, not easy to do. And number two, not every president is elected at a time when the nation wants that to happen. So those leaders of destiny are Washington, Jefferson, in order, Washington, Jefferson, Jackson, Lincoln, Teddy Roosevelt, and Franklin Roosevelt. And I believe that Reagan, who meets the first test of the first test of the contemporaneous judgment of the electorate, and the third test of setting the country on a new course, but is not there yet in terms of the historian polls. I think he will get there. I think he will be ultimately meeting my test and be among the leaders of destiny.
We'll talk about some of these leaders throughout the hour. One question I have is, is it hard to rate them just on their basis, just on the basis of their performance as president? Or do, and I'm thinking of George Washington. A lot of what he did for the country happened before there was a country or a presidency. Thomas Jefferson and the Declaration of Independence. Is it possible to separate out their non-presidential work from their presidential record?
I think it's necessary to separate out their non-presidential work. More recently, we have Jimmy Carter, who probably was one of the greatest ex-presidents in our history. But in order to be an ex-president, you have to be a president, and his performance in office was certainly not sufficient for re-election, so he was not eligible for rehire, as I say. Therefore, I think that if you're looking at it in terms of his presidential performance, what he did afterwards would have to be excluded.
Now, Nat, you mentioned the opportunity to make these changes. Obviously, Abe Lincoln had something that really we hadn't had before or since, the country literally coming apart at the seams. Is it fair just because he happened to be the president at this time of crisis? Did he do enough to earn this list among the greats?
In my view, he did. That's always open to discussion and debate. Of course, this whole thing is open to discussion and debate, which is why I find it so fascinating.
That's part of the fun, yeah.
Mark Twain once said that it's difference of opinion that make horse races, and I think it's difference of opinion that lead to these discussions about presidents as well. But there's a big difference here. With horse races, the difference of opinion ends at the finish line. Here, there's no finish line. It's just endless conversation and discourse and debate. And I say in the book that I'm just really trying to spark that kind of interest in the presidency and that kind of discourse and discussion. Yeah.
Well, when you talk about transformative presidencies, obviously George Washington, it was transformative because it went from no presidency to having one. Abe Lincoln, let's look at the transformations in his era. It's not just the Civil War, is it? It's a change in spending and the concept of what government does, investment in railroads and public universities. Do you consider that whole scope of what he did in raiding him?
Absolutely. I think you have to look at the whole record. Of course, saving the Union and freeing the slaves was what makes him truly a leader of destiny. But these other things were, he set in motion, he helped create and set the direction of the Republican Party, which became the agency of American industrialization after the Civil War. And the whole second half of the 19th century was guided by his party in terms of doing that. What's interesting about this is that there were abuses, however, as that industrialization emerged and progressed and developed. And as those abuses became more and more discernible and problematical, it needed another president, another leader of destiny, to sort of change the debate and say, no, wait a minute, we love this industrialization, we love the economic growth we're getting. It's wonderful to be able to get on trains and go across states and have the telegraph and all the rest of it. But we have to address those abuses, and that was Theodore Roosevelt, who basically said the Republican Party is the party of industrialization and America's industrial might, and I believe in American greatness, but we're going to have to address these problems.
We'll talk about more of the presidents and talk about where they stand throughout this hour. You can join in with your thoughts. The best and worst presidents, the most overrated or underrated in history. 800-642-1234 or talk@WPR.org. Bob Merry joins us this hour to talk about his new book, Where They Stand. He's rating where the presidents stand in the view of history and in the view of the voters of their time. I'm Rob Ferret, filling in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Hurrah for the choice of the nation, our chieftain so brave and so true. We'll go for the great reformation, for Lincoln and liberty too.
Campaign song from Abraham Lincoln. Reproduction, I should say. That wasn't the original soundtrack to his election campaign. Rob Ferret here, filling in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about the presidents of the United States, how they stand in the eyes of history and of their voters of their time. Our guest is Bob Merry. His new book is Where They Stand. And we'll go to the phones now because you've got a lot of people to bring up here. Anita in Gurnee is with us. Hi, Anita.
Hi. This is really fun. I have two people. The second best president, I believe, in spite of all of his personal flaws, which they all have, I think was Bill Clinton, because he brought us into prosperity and he united us. He got the nation enthused. But before that, I really think that Dwight Eisenhower is not given enough credit for his insight and his forethought, and also for his forthrightness. by advising the community at large of the military-industrial complex, for which he paid. He lost a lot of supporters because of that, because the people that make all the money on that were not very happy that he was advising the public at that time, quite naive about such things.
Thanks for the call, Anita. Bob, Mary, let's start with Bill Clinton. Where does he stand in your book?
Well, there are a lot of people who agree with Anita, and I certainly don't dispute that at all. Bill Clinton was a two-term president, not succeeded by his own party, but came very, very close to being succeeded by his own party.
Here's about as close as you can get, yeah.
Yeah, here's what I say about Bill Clinton. He was not a great president, but he was a very good president. He presided over good times, as Anita says, and he did so effectively. His first 2 years were not successful. Any time that in your first midterm, it's very hard to have a positive midterm election after you're president, but when the midterm sort of turns into as disastrous a blow, political blow, as the 94 midterm elections were to Bill Clinton, clearly the electorate is telling him he's doing something wrong. And he immediately shifted, because he came into the office saying he was, and this is a quote, he was going to repeal Reaganism. The problem with attempting to repeal Reaganism at that time was that the American people had voted Reagan in. They had reelected him. They had elected his successor from his party and his vice president. To say that he's going to come in and repeal Reaganism is basically to say, American people, you got it all wrong. You screwed it up, and it's time for me to come in and clean up that mess. They didn't want to hear that, and his policy sort of went along those lines. What he did after 94 was extremely impressive. He calibrated a very cautious but very effective center-left governing philosophy and approach that was just right for the electorate at that time. And as a result of that, he was able to lead the country, as Anita says, very, very effectively for six solid years. And the American people were very appreciative to him of that.
And Anita also liked Dwight Eisenhower for a very particular reason, the military-industrial complex speech. Was that an important part of the Dwight Eisenhower era and legacy?
Well, it came at the end of his term, but it was a very, very significant action on the part of Eisenhower, and it has lingered in significance, and it's really interesting to read about the machinations that went into his decision to give that speech and all of the people around him who told him he shouldn't, et cetera. Here's what I'd say about Eisenhower. He is what I call a split-decision president. The split-decision presidents are two-term presidents not succeeded by their own party. And what we find when we look at them is that their first term is always quite successful, and then that leads to reelection. And their second term inevitably is less successful, sometimes moderately so, sometimes disastrously so, in the case of Nixon, for example, or Lyndon Johnson or Woodrow Wilson. In Eisenhower's case, the differential is really quite mild. His second term was not quite the success of his first term. We had a recession in the election year. There wasn't much in the way of a significant domestic policy initiative. Eisenhower was caught in a lie to the American people regarding the U-2 right in the 1960 period. And Sputnik, the Soviet satellite launch, caused a lot of consternation and concern on the part of the electorate. So Eisenhower is a split-decision president, but I think he deserves to be up there in the near-great category, which is where the historians have him now.
Well, and it was a very near miss for him not to be succeeded by his own party. That was one of the closer presidential outcomes, wasn't it?
Correct. Very close.
Thanks for the call, Anita. Scott in La Crosse is with us now. Scott, you're on the air.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me on. The president I'd like to ask about is one who defies a lot of the criteria, but was sort of true to his own lights, and I'm just really curious as to how you would view him today. And that's James Polk, who, as I understand it, became president really with the intention of being a one-term president, went through and got a lot accomplished, whether it's good or ill, it was certainly what he set out to do, successful in his, but in his own framework. And then at the end of one term said, okay, I'm done, I'm going home. And my understanding is when he left, he was not very popular. But I'm wondering how historians come to view somebody like that who seems to be operating within a framework of his own choosing and getting done what he needs or he thinks he needs to do.
Gotcha. I'll jump in there, Scott. And Bob, I know this is a subject near and dear to your heart. You've also written a biography of Polk, right?
I did. I wrote a history of his administration called A Country of Vast Designs, which came out in 2009. So I spent a lot of time with this guy, and I find him endlessly fascinating. Well, James Polk was, as the caller said, the only president who ran on a one-term promise, which he initiated when he accepted the nomination. He said, if I'm elected, I won't seek a second term. He kept his promise. And he set for himself a number of very, very big goals. He wanted to cut tariff rates, which is kind of like the tax issue today. That's where we got most of our revenue in those days. He wanted to create something called the Independent Treasury, which was kind of like a forerunner to the Federal Reserve. He wanted to get most of, or all of if he could, or at least most of Oregon Territory from the British, which he accomplished. And then he wanted to bring California, which was part of Mexico, into the Union, and he accomplished that. He had to create a war. He basically maneuvered us into a war with Mexico in order to get not just California, but all of what is now the American Southwest. So Polk is a consequential president. He expanded our territory by a third, which is very, very significant. And historians acknowledge that. He is generally categorized in the near great category, and he is the only one-term president to be so honored by the historians. However, he was a very controversial president in his time, largely because of that war, and that controversy has sort of dogged this man in history. He, as I say in the book that I wrote about him, he is, the controversies that surrounded, say, Thomas Jefferson, for example, have totally dissipated, but he was a very controversial president. Or you could name any other president, but the controversies that dogged James Polk during his own time in the White House are still dogging him today. And so he ends up being a very controversial president. There's a biography or a history of the Mexican War that's coming out, published by Knopf, coming out in a few months. That is very, very harsh and goes after Polk and in language that indicates that the author thinks that he's quite a villain in American history. I don't share that view at all.
Thanks for the call, Scott. We'll go now to Anne in Marshfield. Hi, Anne. You're on the air.
Hello, Mr. Murray and Rob. I really appreciate the topic. I would like to mention Calvin Coolidge. I think that he actually did not want the job and pretty much ignored it. Is that true? And then Hoover, I think he is buried in the Depression, and what he did in his term is not recognized. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thanks, Anne. Taking us back to the 20s there. Coolidge and Hoover.
Well, great presidents to talk about. I'm kind of kind to Coolidge in my book on the presidency. I think he's probably underrated. And he's underrated because he wasn't an activist president, but he presided over extremely good times. Economic growth was very robust, although it was beginning to decline rather significantly in the last 2 years of his presidency. He was a two-term president succeeded by his own party, if you include his first term, which is a partial term. He took the presidency at the death of his predecessor. So I would say that he's probably underrated. I think Hoover may be a bit overrated in the historians' polls because Hoover's job was to find a way to get the country out of that depression and to manage the depression when it first emerged upon the scene early in his term. You can only say that he was a failure. He failed to do that, and the American people unceremoniously separated him from the presidency at the next opportunity, and I think they were probably right to do that. I think that he made some big, big mistakes. The first one was signing the Smoot-Hawley tariff bill, which I think exacerbated the situation tremendously. He raised taxes in the middle of that depression in a way that was very harmful, and it was retroactive in those days. It wasn't withholding. So the result was that people had to go into their savings in order to pay their tax bills at the end of the year. And some economists or economic historians believe that that's what led to the run on the banks that occurred just at the end of his term that Franklin Roosevelt had to deal with. So I'm not very high on Hoover, but I'm higher on Coolidge than the historians have been.
Well, and we talked earlier about having a big opportunity to make changes, being a transformative president, looking good in the eyes of historians. Do we undervalue the guy, like maybe Silent Cal, who just stayed the course when it needed to be stayed?
That's my view. I don't think that we should necessarily dock a guy. And the previous caller talking about Clinton would be a good example. Dock a guy because he didn't happen to preside over turbulent times.
Thanks for the call. We'll go to Mark in Princeton now. Hi, Mark.
Good morning, and this is a great topic. I really enjoy listening to it. I would say, with respect to the gentleman, and his scholarship sounds really solid, that I would not make a category of these presidents in the order in which you have ranked them as great. I would call them significant. I think you're right. Is that they have caused the country to embark on a different course, but that course wasn't necessarily a positive one in every particular case. Now, Andrew Jackson, I can't rank somebody as great for what he did to the Cherokee and driving them westward on the Trail of Tears. I can't do that, for example. That's not great. And you talk about a run on the banks. Well, his attack on the Bank of the United States sparked a run on the banks and a depression right after he left office.
Right. Thanks for the call, Mark. And that's something you address directly in the book. Andrew Jackson, a lot of different perspectives on him and people raising exactly the objections that Mark just raised.
A lot of controversy has trailed Andrew Jackson over the decades, and I think it may be as intense now as it's ever been, maybe excluding the time when he actually was president. Here's what I have to say about Andrew Jackson and the caller's observations about him. One of the things that sort of motivated me here was the idea that I wanted to generate discourse, and this is precisely the kind of discourse that I had in mind. So I really respect the caller's judgment on this. The Trail of Tears was a terrible national tragedy, and I think that it tends to be, in minds of a lot of people, a kind of a blot on our history. It also was a inevitable clash of cultures that probably weren't going to be able to meld in any successful way. And in that sense, Jackson was doing, and this is one of the themes of my book, which can raise some controversy, which I appreciate, Jackson was essentially executing the policies that the American people wanted, because these people had this grand vision of opportunity of creating this country and the opportunity of creating the opportunity of expansion that they didn't want anything in their way. So as tragic as it was and as justifiable as anyone is in lamenting and attacking verbally Jackson's memory, you can look at it in that way as well. One can argue it endlessly about the Bank of the U.S. I happen to believe that Jackson was right in those policies, and I'm not sure that the actual killing of the bank was what led to the Panic of 1837, although that's a very debatable topic.
Thanks for bringing up Andrew Jackson. Rob Ferret here, filling in for Kathleen Dunn, talking to Bob Mary about his new book, Where They Stand. We're rating the presidents throughout American history. Next on the line is Rose. She's in Stevens Point. Hi, Rose.
Hi. I have only been to one presidential library, and that was Hoover. And it told how wonderful he was before he became president, many good things he did for Europe and so on. And I think he does not fit the old saying of the cream rises to the top, because maybe he should have stopped at the level below the top. And I wonder if you have ideas like that about other presidents that have just gone too far in their careers, that didn't come up with all the things we expected of them.
The Peter principle is applied to presidents, I think, Bob Mary. Are there other people who were great Americans and should have stopped before they got into the Oval Office?
Well, it's interesting to look at the presidents who came into office with the greatest qualifications. And one would be Hoover, so the caller is very, very correct to note that about him. Another one would be Richard Nixon. Richard Nixon had traveled widely throughout the world. He was a real thinker. He had been vice president for 8 years, been in the Senate and the House, served in the military during the war. And obviously, he had some character flaws that led to the greatest presidential humiliation in our history. The great qualifications or the great sort of preparation for the presidency isn't always necessarily the ticket to success. Look at Abraham Lincoln, a single term in Congress, quite a few years before he became president, struggling really to make his way in Illinois politics, and emerges sort of out of nowhere, widely viewed as a kind of a bumpkin from the sticks of Illinois, and yet turns out to be a political genius.
Thanks for the call, Rose. We've had a couple lines open up if you were trying to get in earlier at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. If you want to ask where a president stands or offer an opinion on the best, worst, over or underrated president in American history, 800-642-1234. You were just mentioning Nixon, and Jeff in Madison has something to say about Richard Nixon. Hi, Jeff.
Yeah, more than just Nixon, a quick example of Nixon. I strongly resist the temptation to use re-election as any kind of criterion of greatness or even, greatness. And just two quick examples. One has only to consider Nixon's, at the time, likely re-election, but for a bungled burglary. And one has to consider whether re-election would somehow have glossed over his obvious negatives, Cambodia, use of FBI against protesters, et cetera. And the other quick example, Reagan, whom you've mentioned, is viewed by so many as carrying some kind of halo over his head, and yet, according to Ben Friedman in his book Day of Reckoning, which was written right at the end of Reagan's administration, noted Harvard economist, it was Reagan's administration that basically changed a 200-year-old tradition of Americans actually paying for what we want from government with taxes, rather than running overseas to borrow to fund what seem to be now our ever-growing and limitless deficits. So I hope history will take a look at the economic impacts of the Reagan administration and not just communications, which always sounds, the great communicator, which sounds a little shallow to me. Anyway, I'll listen off air. Thanks.
Thanks for the call, Jeff. Response to either of those comments, Bob?
Yeah, absolutely. I think I would like to take the opportunity to respond by talking a little bit about the thesis of the book. I believe that presidential elections are largely referendums on the incumbent, so that what the challenger says or does, or gaffes, or funding, fundraising differentials, all the things that we as political reporters, and I used to be one, concentrate on so much during a campaign are not really that significant. I believe that the voters somehow collectively, it's almost a mystical thing, somehow collectively rise to a judgment about the performance of the president over the course of the last 4 years. And since I happen to believe that the system actually works, I tend to think that when you look at that judgment in the course of history and look at it in terms of how the voters do, which is in four-year increments, they're not looking for a historical perspective here. They're just looking at the question that Reagan posed to Jimmy Carter or during the debate with Jimmy Carter, are you better off than you were 4 years ago? And that's how they assess it. And from that perspective, I believe, this is rebuttable, of course, and debatable, but I believe that there's a collective logic that propels that decision-making, and therefore there's a logic that propels the country forward and directs the country in terms of where it goes. In the case of Reagan, I don't agree with the caller entirely. There's no question that Reagan left a significant debt load that came about as a result of the deficits that he allowed during his presidency. But the fact is that the deficits were coming down rather dramatically in his second term to a point where they had reached a level of being quite manageable. And it was subsequent actions under the presidency of George Herbert Walker Bush, whom I don't have as much regard for, that had that deficit sort of going back in the wrong direction. And after all, in the very next presidency, debt was coming down. I mean, we were paying off the debt to a significant extent. So I don't believe that Reagan is the first president who basically said we're not going to pay for what we're getting. The fact of the matter is that government was expanding rather significantly, and it was Carter's last budget that projected a expense base of as a percentage of GDP that basically sent the markets south. And the American people basically said, we need a president to come in and change this. And they did. And he did.
That's Bob Mary, author of the new book, Where They Stand. We're talking about how we rate the presidents throughout American history. I'm Rob Ferret, filling in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Rob Ferret, filling in for Kathleen Dunn this week. This hour, we are talking to Bob Mary about his new book, Where They Stand. He's rating the American presidents throughout history using the views of historians and of the voters at the time. We'll get back to your calls in just a moment at 800-642-1234. But, Bob, one name that we probably shouldn't ignore this hour is Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Where does he stand?
Well, he's clearly, by my lights, a leader of destiny. He's generally, by the historians, ranked number three. Most of the historian rankings have it Lincoln, Washington, and FDR in that order. FDR came in at crisis time. Obviously, the country had to move in a new direction. The political landscape had to be changed because the political landscape couldn't handle the problems that had descended upon the nation. And Roosevelt did that, and he did it quite brilliantly. He brought about some tremendous economic growth, although the country was in such a slew of economic despond that still it had a long ways to go during the whole 30s prior to World War II. So he transformed the politics of America. And once he did that and saw what was happening in the world, he decided that he wanted to get the United States into that war, that it was a necessity of history. And he transformed the world. So that's a tall, tall order for any president. And so he definitely stands very, very high.
But there is still, he's still a kind of a polarizing figure in some ways, whether it's because of Japanese internment camps or court stacking, creating a much larger government, or some say he abandoned too much of Eastern Europe to the Soviet Union. A lot of warts that people point there. Can we overlook those?
No, and we shouldn't. But you can't transform the country and transform the world without having some, you know, detritus along the way, and certainly Roosevelt did. I mean, I think that he did some things prior to World War II in his efforts to get America into the war that were definitely impeachable offenses. His deal with the Brits over the destroyers, now this is not Lend-Lease, this is something separate that he did highly secretively, I think was a violation of the Neutrality Act. And if the country had been in a different climate at that time, could have been an impeachable offense. And so that's part of, and one could argue that Lincoln also, in terms of riding roughshod over civil liberties and taking a congressman he didn't like from Ohio and throwing him in jail and then shipping him off, exiling him to Canada. What in the world in the Constitution allows that kind of behavior? History is not neat and tidy. It can be quite messy, but when you step back and look at it whole, you see that there are these presidents that have these huge impacts upon the country and the world, and I'm not saying they're necessarily right or wrong or good or bad, but they definitely were leaders of destiny.
Back to the phones now with Bud in Waukesha. Hi, Bud.
Good morning. Excuse me. Just two quick observations or questions, invitations for response. It strikes me that electorates vary over time, and we're not acknowledging that right away when we just focus, as history tends to, on the great man theory. but it was a different problem getting elected, nominated and elected in 1848, 1888, and 2008. And those circumstances are part of what would contribute to or diminish the greatness or the success of any candidate. Secondly, how much greatness or failure is properly and necessarily attributed to the people around the president, the people with whom he surrounds himself, with whom he can work or chooses to work? I get desperate sometimes when people approach an election and think, well, we'll elect one person and that'll solve everything. He can do it all by himself. Beyond overlooking the problems between Congress and executive, the function of anybody in the modern office has to be the function of somebody who knows how to work through others. And it had to have been a different problem for Lincoln and a very different problem for Washington, but they've all had it at different times.
Thanks for the call, Bud. A couple interesting questions there. Bob?
Very, very interesting. Well, I think those two questions are really very much interrelated. But let me take the last one first. There's absolutely no question that the president is dependent upon tremendous numbers of people that he bring in to help him run the country and lead the country. But, of course, he's responsible for putting the right people in place, and so he gets the credit or he gets the blame, and I find that that's probably the way it ought to be, because that leads to political accountability, which is what our system is based on. In terms of the question of things changing over time, there's absolutely no question that that's true, and that that we can step back and say, yes, indeed, the problems or the way you could deal with problems, the magnitude of problems might have been very, very different in different times. Certainly, I think James Polk, a person I've studied pretty carefully, I'm sure he didn't have more than 12 people in his White House staff. I don't know how many we have in the White House staff today, but it's certainly, just drive by the old executive office building and realize that there's a new executive office building as well, and there's the West Wing, and it's huge. So, yeah, that's a very, very different situation. But on the other hand, in our system, the founders created a mechanism for the voters to assess their leaders and to take action, peaceful action, in order to determine whether they merit re-election or are eligible for rehire, as I put it. And so ultimately it ends up being the same thing. So we can say, yes, this guy was a president in a far, far different time, but he had the same challenge, which was to respond to the will of the American people in a way that the American people would feel that the country was in good and safe hands. And that's the same challenge that a president has today.
Thanks for the call, Bud. Zeb in Green Bay is with us now. Hi, Zeb.
Hi. I was just wondering who the guest thinks was the worst president of all time, whether it was James Buchanan or George Bush. And I'll take his answer off air.
Love the question. I feel that the worst president was James Buchanan. I also think he was the worst man ever to get into the White House. I think he was a man of limited character. He was the Secretary of State under James Polk, so I know a bit about how he operated, and he had no loyalty whatsoever. And he was essentially a dishonest man. He lied to the American people upon assuming the office when he said in his inaugural address that he would accept the court's decision in the forthcoming looming Dred Scott issue. When he did that, when he said that to the American people, he already knew what the court's decision was going to be, and he favored it. So when he uttered that to the American people, he was uttering a lie in his own inaugural address, so he kicked off his administration with such behavior. He's definitely the worst president of our history.
Do he and other pre-Civil War presidents get docked for not solving the problems that ultimately led to the Civil War?
They do, and it may not be fair because the problems were so dire. And yet, that's what they're elected to do. They're elected to solve the problems of the nation and to bring civic success to the country. And if they can't do that, that doesn't mean that they're bad people. In the case of Buchanan, I think he happened to be a bad person, but I don't think that his predecessor, Franklin Pierce, was a bad person. But Franklin Pierce failed to grapple with the magnitude of the slavery issue in the same way that Buchanan did, and so it had to be somebody else. And just think about what Lincoln did. He transformed the debate in America when he said, I uttered these famous words, a house divided against itself cannot stand. See, what was happening in American politics was that everybody was trying to prop up this house. And it was a divided house, but everyone sort of accepted the division of the house that said we're going to have to prop it up so it can stand. And Lincoln came in and changed the debate by essentially saying a house divided against itself cannot stand. Now, he said, I don't expect the house to fall. I just expect it to become all one thing or all the other because it can't. This is not sustainable. And transforming the debate in that way led to his election, number one, led to secession, number two, and led to his opportunity to free the slaves and pull the country back together without slavery. That's the measure of greatness in our political system.
Thanks for the call, Zeb. Matt in Chippewa Falls is next. Matt, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. I like the show so far. It's great. I was wondering, I guess, do you think, it seems to me anyway, that a lot of presidents that, you know, didn't significantly alter, you know, take great action, I guess. It seems to me the presidents that kept us out of wars or were in office when we weren't in war really get downplayed. And, I mean, for example, I think Grover Cleveland was a good president, a great president, advocated gold standard. And actually, it was interesting because he was president two non-consecutive terms. I was hoping to get your comments on that.
Thanks for calling in, Matt. Grover Cleveland.
Well, Grover Cleveland is an interesting case, and I like the guy a lot. But here's where we come into a rather significant disparity between what the historians have said about Grover Cleveland and what the voters were saying contemporaneous to his tenure in office. In the first poll that was conducted, as I say, by Arthur Schlesinger Sr. in 1948, Grover Cleveland was ranked eighth. And that's very high ranking. He's slipped down, but he's still in the sort of 14, 15, 16 range. But consider the voters. Now, we don't know much about Grover Cleveland in our country today, but we do know that he's the only president who served two non-consecutive terms. After each of those terms, the voters tossed his party out of the White House. So another way of saying it is that Grover Cleveland is, in our history, the only two-time, one-term president, which is not a great recommendation if you believe, as I do, that the voters' assessment of a person's, a president's term in office is significant in terms of his performance. So there's a rather wide disparity between the historians and the voters, and I tend to think that probably the voters' judgment should be cranked in just a little bit more in the historians' rankings.
Thanks for the call, Matt. Time for another call from Howard in Milwaukee. Hi, Howard.
Good morning. I work in the environmental field, and people ask me, well, who do you think is a great environmental president? And I answer unequivocally, one of the greatest environmental presidents in American history, Richard Nixon. Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, the Superfund Act, Environmental Protection Agency, Endangered Species Act, all these things that make our lives better every single day had its genesis under Richard Nixon. And I wonder what your thoughts are on that.
Well, that's a counterexample. I had mentioned maybe downsides to a highly ranked president like FDR. Here, he's making the case for upsides for a president who gets a lower ranking like Richard Nixon.
Nixon poses a classic question in all this, which is, what do you do about a president who finds himself in so much ignominy that it's almost impossible for the historians to bring him up in the standings? In other words, does Watergate basically wash away everything else that he did? It doesn't seem quite fair, and yet he is down there in the utter failure category in almost all of the historian polls. And the fact is that he accomplished a great deal, not just in domestic affairs. He certainly did in terms of the environment. He also did in terms of foreign affairs. What he accomplished in Asia during his first term in getting us out of Vietnam, while doing it in a way that allowed America to remain in Asia and to bring China into the community of nations, and to do it in a way that didn't upset the emerging democratic and more capitalistic nations that were emerging in places like Taiwan and Singapore and the Philippines or Indonesia, perhaps. And that was brilliant diplomacy. And Nixon, in terms of the actual polls of the historians, doesn't get any credit for that at all because he's down there in the bottom five. Another good example of this would be Lyndon Johnson.
I want to jump in because we're just about out of time, and I just wanted to get your thoughts. You've written a book on Polk. In 30 seconds or so, is there another president that fascinates you enough that makes you want to write a book about them?
I'm in the process of looking at the 1890s and William McKinley. And the decision on the part of America, collective decision, to basically become something of an empire and to bust out of our continental confines and go out into the world. And that fascinates me. So something might emerge out of that.
Right. Thanks a lot for joining us this hour.
Thank you.
That was Bob Mary. We've been talking about his new book, Where They Stand, The American Presidents in the Eyes of Voters and Historians. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and Brett Jaspers for producing the program. Rhonda Fanning also for on-air production today. Thanks for listening, and thanks for all your great calls. It's been a lot of fun this hour. Larry Mueller's coming in next. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.